There's a reason why giving birth has such a high mortality rate worldwide.
AFE is really an uncommon complication, but it has devastating outcomes.
They're among the most rapidly crashing patients that I've seen.
Could this somehow be endotoxin-mediated septic shock or even acute myocardial infarction? Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. This is Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. And we have reached almost the end of 2019. We're here in December 2019. For all of you in the U.S., we hope that you had a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday, had some great time to spend with family and friends. We are excited here to be wrapping up 2019. We've got a few more podcasts to go, one of which is going to be our year-end articles of the year. But for this podcast, we're going to talk about a very rare event, thankfully a rare event, but a catastrophic event in the peripartum patient that absolutely can present the crashing peripartum patient. And it is important to consider this diagnosis. We're going to talk about some pearls in terms of recognition, subsequent diagnosis, and then really what to do to manage these critically ill peripartum patients. But before doing that, let me bring in my co-host, Dr. Peter W., Dr. Rob Rodriguez, and Dr. John Greenwood. Let me ask you guys, how are you doing this podcast?
Doing great. Thank you.
Likewise, doing very, very well.
Yeah, doing awesome, Mike. Had a very successful Philadelphia Marathon weekend this past Saturday and Sunday. Had no significant events that I'm aware of on Sunday. And on Saturday did have two unfortunate incidences of racers who got critically ill. One actually had CPR by a cardiologist in the field. It was quite a tremendous story that got saved. But overall, doing well. Thanks.
That's awesome. How is that patient doing?
I've heard doing well, and interestingly enough, the cardiologist was a runner running alongside of him when had the witnessed arrest. So the runner and patient were very fortunate.
That is unbelievable. We had the Baltimore Running Festival in October, and I didn't hear of anything this year, but in the last several years, there has always been one or two cardiac arrests that, given our proximity to the start and finish of the race, a lot of these patients are brought to us at Maryland. Thankfully, we didn't have any this year, and certainly we hope that that person up in Philly makes a good recovery. Well, John, I'm going to turn things over to you for this education this month in terms of the podcast and kind of let you guide us along in this discussion for this very important can't-miss topic.
Absolutely, Mike. And I wanted to bring this topic to the podcast partly because the management of this patient. This is a quintessential critical care patient. The things that we have to do in a very timely fashion hit on multiple different organ systems and need to be done in a very rapid time frame. But it's also a very unique time in the emergency department. And I don't know about you guys, but I personally don't enjoy delivering babies in the emergency department. I find that in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking about or worried about all the things that can go wrong. And it's not uncommon that the team at the time when you're doing these precipitous deliveries is very focused on what commonly happens, which is the fun, the enjoyment, the new family, things like that. But as clinicians, particularly ones who have been practicing for a little while, we all know that there's a lot of things that can go wrong in a delivery. And one of these is a very significant diagnosis, and that's the amniotic fluid embolism. And we're going to use pearls and little points taken from two main articles. One is the amniotic fluid embolism written by Shim Shiraz. This was back in 2016 in Obstetric Gynecology Clinics of North America. And then the Society of MFM just recently updated their diagnosis and management guidelines. So we're going to talk about the recommendations there and kind of walk through this in a systematic way, but definitely something every ED provider needs to be prepared for, because AFE is a catastrophic syndrome and can occur either during delivery, so while the patient's actively laboring, or closely after. And that's really important because although this is uncommon, women who die or develop unexpected cardiovascular collapse, AFE is statistically the most likely diagnosis. The true incidence, we really don't know, but it's estimated to occur in about every 10 to 50,000 deliveries. And unfortunately, we really don't have a gold standard test for the diagnosis of AFE. It's often made by clinical presentation. Now, many of the signs and symptoms of AFE overlap with other more common obstetric complications, such as hemorrhagic shock from postpartum hemorrhage, anaphylaxis from maybe medication administration, or even placental abruption. So the fact that this diagnosis is really challenging and can present with symptoms very similar to other complications, Mike, maybe you could walk us through the recognition and diagnosis of amniotic fluid embolism.
John, that's an outstanding introduction. And let me hit on a few key points. And when you're confronted with a crashing peripartum patient, there's a handful of things that really should immediately come to mind. And we're thinking many of these things. So did the patient or does the patient have a PE? Could this be anaphylaxis? Could this somehow be endotoxin-mediated septic shock or even acute myocardial infarction? Specific to this patient population, thinking about AFE, but also placental abruption, uterine rupture, eclampsia, and potentially peripartum cardiomyopathy are the other specific things that we want to be thinking about in that critically ill, all of a sudden crashing peripartum patient. Now, let me start with just the two big key take-home pearls in terms of recognizing this condition and diagnosing it. Most commonly, AFE is going to present usually within the first 30 minutes of delivery. So this happens very soon after delivery. And typically there's a classic progression of symptoms. So you'll note that the patient starts off with hypoxemia, followed thereafter by hypotension, and then developing some type of hemorrhagic shock. And that's usually secondary to DIC that we'll touch on a little bit later when we hit on coagulopathy. Now, when this was first described, often we've probably learned about this, thinking that AFE was really thought to be due to this large bolus of fetal material, namely amniotic fluid, returning or placed into the maternal circulation. However, we know that that's probably not accurate. In fact, new research suggests that this condition is really not embolic, but it's more like an inappropriate host response to these fetal antigens. And what happens is the body develops or releases this massive inflammatory response to those fetal antigens, and it ultimately results in multi-system organ failure. One of the hallmark organs that is involved, presenting once again with hypoxemia, is going to be the pulmonary circulation. In fact, patients are going to develop acute pulmonary hypertension, and that's usually due to some endothelial exposure to that amniotic fluid, to those fetal antigens, and subsequent this massive inflammatory response. So we talked about the things to consider in that rapid, quick differential. And once again, the classic triad is typically hypoxemia from pulmonary hypertension, and in some cases, the rapid development of ARDS, followed by hypotension from a vasoplegic response due to that inflammatory response, and then ultimately hemorrhage secondary to coagulopathy, namely resulting from DIC.
That's awesome, Mike. And I think you point out something that's really, really important here, and that's the early presence of hypoxemia. A lot of the diagnoses and the differential that you talked about will present with hypotension and maybe even coagulopathy or bleeding, as this is often a traumatic environment with the delivery, but that hypoxemia can really key us in that perhaps something else is going on. So let's say that the patient just delivered, baby came out 2-3 minutes ago, and the mother's complaining of shortness of breath. You look up, the monitor says saturations are going down. Peter, maybe walk us through how you're approaching this patient if you're considering this diagnosis early on and what you might do for early management.
Well, thanks, John and Mike, for setting that up. I think it's really important for us to realize that we don't typically do deliveries in the ED, which was brought up earlier. But having said that, it makes it a high tension time. So we want to make sure that OB is incorporated early. Peds will probably be in the house as well because we need to get everybody prepared. When we manage these sick folks, they're typically managed utilizing both the surgical and medical approach. So you have to kind of be prepared for both sides of this. Understand that OB may actually choose to perform an emergency hysterotomy in the crashing patient because the fetus is often in distress if he's not already out, secondary to uterine malperfusion. As soon as hypoxia is recognized, it's important to address what are known as the two big early killers from AFE, and those two are number one, hypoxia, and the second one is acute right ventricular dysfunction. So as soon as hypoxia is recognized, it's important to address the early killers from AFE, which are number one, hypoxia, and number two, right ventricular dysfunction or acute right heart failure. So early focus point of care echo and ultrasound can really identify this right ventricular dysfunction and dilation, along with other signs of pressure overload, which may be due to acute pulmonary hypertension. When we start talking about reversing hypoxemia, we're going to go very quickly to 100% non-rebreather, but be prepared for rapid sequence intubation, understanding that peripartum patients are at profound high risk. Again, already fall off the oxygenation curve very early due to pregnancy status, but also their tissues are friable, so they're easily damaged. So this isn't somebody that you're going to want to muck around with, and also understand that they're at risk for aspiration and emesis. So when we're cautious with the intubation, it may be inevitable. Be prepared to intubate using a right ventricular protective strategy. So this is what? It may include pre-intubation initiation of a vasopressor. And it looks like epinephrine may be the ideal vasopressor. So this may be the time to shake off the norepinephrine trend and reach for epi or other inotropic support. Early initiation of inhaled epoprostenol or nitric oxide. This coincides with the systemic use of inodilators, either dobutamine or milrinone may be beneficial. We have to be really cautious that this may not be completely due to pulmonary edema, poor peripheral perfusion due to right ventricular failure, or an obstructive shock picture can also give you a low pulse ox value. So we still have to be broad with our consideration and differential diagnosis. The fluid management in these folks is really precarious. These are the kind of things where you give a 250cc bolus, and if you're getting worse, you don't give a repeat bolus. But if you give a 250cc bolus over 5 to 10 minutes and they get better, you may consider a second one. This makes it tough, particularly in the setting of active or recent delivery. But in general, patients with right heart failure do not tolerate aggressive fluid resuscitation. If the patient does arrest, we're going to go to our strict ACLS recommendations. There's nothing fancy about these. But that's the early approach. Again, trying to address number one, hypoxia, and number two, acute right ventricular dysfunction.
Peter, those are phenomenal pearls. There's a lot to unpackage there, but certainly the thing that stands out most, or at least to me, is the thought about how complex this intubation is going to potentially be, particularly if the patient's going to get emergent surgical procedures by OB, go to intubate this person, they get hypotensive, going straight to a vasopressor as opposed to the traditional fluid bolus that was maybe traditionally taught, certainly is going to be more ideal in this circumstance, but really, really a great summary. But now let's move on to maybe one of the more challenging parts to manage in the progression from hypoxemia to hypotension, the bleeding aspect of amniotic fluid embolism. So Rob, I'm going to kick this one to you. How should we be thinking about approaching the bleeding in this complicated patient?
Yeah, John, it's important to recognize that while hypoxemia and cardiovascular collapse are often the early killers in patients with AFE, coagulopathy and the development of DIC with hemorrhagic shock are the primary causes of death in patients who survive their initial resuscitation. So coagulopathy is a big deal in these patients. In terms of pathophysiology of the coagulopathy, amniotic fluid causes platelet activation and complement activation. Amniotic fluid is of itself also a significant source of tissue factor, leading to hyperfibrinolysis. This can lead to devastating bleeding in these patients who already may have active postpartum bleeding from just having delivered. In terms of treatment, uterine atony in these patients is common, and the use of oxytocin or prostaglandins should be considered to attempt to minimize the problems with uterine atony. Sometimes the obstetrician may decide to perform an emergent hysterotomy, and in this case, they will often perform damage control pelvic packing and have a delayed closure. It's important to recognize abnormal bleeding from IV sites, hematuria, GI hemorrhage, or worsening of the vaginal or surgical site bleeding. These are all important clues when considering DIC. TEG-guided therapy may be useful in these patients. And resuscitation of the actively hemorrhaging patient should include bounce blood product resuscitation, or in other words, massive transfusion protocols. Try to keep the quantitative platelet count greater than 50K and normalize PTT with FFP and cryo. The use of PCCs has not been well described in these patients. Another thing to consider is early TXA or tranexamic acid or aminocaproic acid. These have been reported in some series to be of benefit. And finally, the use of recombinant factor 7 has been described, but its use can be considered as a last resort because it comes with significant risk of thrombosis in these patients. So a key pearl in all of this is beware of making the diagnosis of AFT prematurely in critically ill obstetrics patients and treating uterine atony with secondary coagulopathy.
All right. So, Rob, that was an awesome summary. And certainly this is complex in terms of management, the coagulopathy with an AFE. And again, taking a step back, we always have to remember that common things being common, the most common cause of bleeding in patients who are delivering babies is certainly things like uterine atony. And there's a reason why giving birth has such a high mortality rate worldwide. And it's usually not due to AFE. However, if you're recognizing things such as hypoxemia and right ventricular dysfunction, again, this has to be on your differential. So thinking that maybe this bleeding is DIC and not just usual bleeding is going to be critical here. And so I think as we move on to, should the patient who's really sick have a cardiac arrest due to DIC and hemorrhage, or maybe hypoxemia or RV failure, there still are a number of things that we should be considering as resuscitationists in managing this patient because it's not over. These are usually really young, healthy patients, and we're going to pull out all the stops to try and hopefully get this young woman to a good neurologic outcome and home with her family. So certainly our hemodynamic targets should be considering a MAP greater than 65. We really want to avoid hyperoxia after intubating if we find that on our post-intubation ABG. If the patient did arrest prior to an emergency hysterotomy, targeted temperature management should be considered for neurologic survival purposes. If they're actively bleeding, we might want to consider moving to a 36-degree target rather than the traditional 33 to prevent secondary ischemic reperfusion injury. And I think at the end of the day, it's important to really sit down and talk with family. Oftentimes we get so encapsulated with this resuscitation and things move so fast, the patient moves upstairs. The family who has just gone from this elated emotional experience of a delivery to a devastation, it's really important to sit down, talk to them about what happened and what the next steps are. It can be easy to forget about that, but super important. So just to wrap up, Rob, Peter, and Mike, any take-home pearls that you want to leave us with as we wrap up this podcast? Peter, let's start with you.
Yeah, I would start with really 2 points. And one of the things that John talked about was kind of debriefing with the family, but I would also look to debrief with my team because this is really a funky time in the ED for all the care providers, particularly if things don't go well. I would also remember that AFE is really an uncommon complication, but it has devastating outcomes. So just be wary about it.
Excellent. Rob, anything you'd like to leave us with?
I think these are high intensity situations. As Peter alluded to, you really got to pay attention to your team and teamwork and family. They're among the most rapidly crashing patients that I've seen. You really have to just really have a high vigilance for this and be aggressive about your resuscitation.
Excellent. And Mike, take us home.
You guys went over some outstanding pearls there. I don't have a whole lot to add other than the fact that I think probably all of us out there have those processes in place for when a pregnant patient comes in the act of labor. We quickly assess patients and get them up to labor and delivery. But on occasion, there will be that precipitous delivery. And depending on the circumstances, mom and subsequently baby may in fact be in the emergency department for 30, 45 minutes. And it's during that time frame when this deadly condition can present. So when mom starts to develop hypoxemia and then drops her pressure, and then may start to have hemorrhage and bleeding, that really is the classic triad of amniotic fluid embolism. And really just thinking about this diagnosis is perhaps one of the most critical pearls that I can impart with respect to this podcast. And then once you've thought about the diagnosis, really, Peter, you outlined some really great pearls in terms of the early assessment, the early management, and the early resuscitation of these patients.
Excellent, Mike. Well, I think that wraps up for this edition of Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Thank you, Michael, Peter, and Rob for an outstanding review on the topic, and certainly something that was a good refresher for me for my next precipitous delivery, which hopefully will not be for quite some time. But with that being said, thanks so much to the audience. And I know that, Mike, you have some plans for upcoming podcasts in doing our year in literature review. So looking forward to that. And until then, we'll talk to you guys soon. Bye-bye.